It is time for the Border News Roundup. Friday mornings, we get a chance to check in with Marshall Helmberger. He's the publisher and editor of the Timber Jates, a newspaper serving northeastern Minnesota. Thanks for being with us today, Marshall.
Happy to be here, Heidi.
Well, let's start off with a story about a study by the Campaign to Save the Boundary Waters about economics having to do with the copper nickel mining.
Right. And this study was actually commissioned by the Campaign to Save the Boundary Waters. They hired a company out of Washington, D.C., known as Keylog Economics. Basically, they wanted them to look at what some of the economic costs might be of starting a copper-nickel mine on the edge of the Boundary Waters and in the Ely area. You know, it's been an argument that they've made for a number of years. The opponents of the mine have argued that you can't just look at the benefits of adding new jobs. You also have to look at what kind of economic activity would be displaced as a result of copper-nickel mine. So this study, you know, looked at that, looked at a number of different issues and trends, you know, looked at economic data, and basically, as a result of it, predicting that there would be the loss of thousands of jobs and hundreds of millions of dollars in annual income to the region if a copper-nickel mine were actually to become established along the edge of the Boundary Waters. That finding is certainly going to get this whole debate riled up again, I'm sure, about copper-nickel. And, of course, it's coming just as the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management are in the midst of scoping for a study, for that two-year study that they're doing on the possible withdrawal of a significant portion of the Superior National Forest from the Federal Mineral Leasing Program. And I think this study was put out, I think, timed, you know, to address that issue. And basically, I did talk to the lead author on this, Spencer Phillips, and he's arguing that the Forest Service needs to basically take a look at some of the issues that they've raised here, some of the data that they're presenting, and they do this study because they can't just look at, like I said, the impact of new jobs in mining. You have to look at how many jobs in other areas might be lost. And I should mention that Spencer Phillips, he's an economist. He actually was an economist with the White House Council on Environmental Quality under the first Bush administration, later worked for the Wilderness Society. And basically, you know, the study is challenging the argument of mining boosters who have for a long time said we can have both. You know, we can have a healthy tourism-based economy as well as new jobs in mining. And they're saying they don't believe that's actually the case. And they point to a number of different sources of data, one of them being a study that was done in actually 2014 by the University of Minnesota Morris. And they had done a survey of residents in the Ely area. Actually, it was a Morris, Fall Lake, Eagles Nest, and Stony River townships. They asked people, one of the questions was, you know, why do you live in the area? What kind of things drew you here? The overwhelming response from township residents was nature, you know, outdoor recreation, peace and quiet, solitude, things like that, water quality. And then they asked them what kinds of things would be most likely to make them leave the area. And the number one thing they indicated would be mining. And in fact, 23% of the residents surveyed, and they got a very good response from this. It was about a 60% return rate, as I recall, on that study, because we reported on it at the time. 23% of the respondents said they'd be likely to leave the area as a result of mining. You know, I think there's some basis to think that, you know, people who have moved into the area for, you know, the types of values that, you know, are associated with, you know, the Boundary Waters, Superior National Forest, you know, the Ely area, that a significant percentage of them could choose to move away where substantial mining industry to start to, you know, be built up in this area. That's the basis for the study's argument that there would be a substantial job loss as a result of that. You know, and a lot of people think about tourism as, well, it's restaurants and hotels and resorts and things like that. But they argue that actually, you know, that you have to look at tourism in a much broader context, and they say most of the impact actually is to other sectors of the economy, like construction being a big one, real estate, finance, other professional services, automotive, things like that. They're arguing that once you consider it in that broader context and the amount of economic activity created by people who have moved to the area, whether, you know, whether they're seasonal or decide to be permanent, the impact of what they call an amenity-based lifestyle or economy, which is, you know, based on outdoor recreation and just, you know, nature, things like that, there really is a significant impact if you start to lose that. In fact, they made an interesting point in the study, which was that, and this surprised me, that in the air, and I should mention this covers the Arrowhead, which was St. Louis, Cook, and Lake counties. But since 2000, there have been 10,000 new residential units built in that region, even though the overall population has not increased by anywhere near that amount. They said what this really reflects is the investment that lots of people have made in seasonal residences or retirement residences that have become full-time. And they said along with people moving to the area, even if it's just seasonally, you also get the income that those people have. They noted that the amount of what they call non-labor income in the region has actually increased by a third since 2000. And what they're saying is those are people who've moved here. They may not be working. They may be retired. They're moving into the area, but their incomes still now, you know, have economic impact throughout the economy up here. Just like, you know, any other worker who has income, that income is you know, generates activity in the local economy. It's the same thing with somebody who moves here from outside the area. They said the other thing about it is that, you know, while somebody who's working here, their dollars are more likely to remain tied to the area because they come with a job, people who have moved to the area for certain natural amenities, they're much more sensitive to any kind of erosion or diminishment of those values that drew them to the area. They can pick up and leave. You know, if they're not happy because there's a mine down the road now and there's dust and noise and water pollution and things like that, they can find someplace else. So this is the basis of their argument. And overall, I mean, they indicated that the loss of jobs, you know, could be as much as 22,000 jobs, which I think is pretty high, you know, and whether or not they've got the economic data to support that, I think is questionable. But I think there's no doubt that there will be a significant impact on the negative side of the ledger as a result of this. And basically, they're making the argument right now that the Forest Service, as part of its study, needs to take a serious look at this whole issue and determine, you know, whether or not in the end, even if you're adding mining jobs, if you're losing an equivalent number of jobs or even more jobs in other areas of the economy, that I think they're raising the issue is, do you come out ahead or behind?
Okay. Well, I'm sure this whole story and what's going on in terms of copper nickel mining will continue on. And
well, and it's going to continue on Tuesday down in Virginia because there's a big hearing. The Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management who are coming to take public input on that that study. And there's going to be a rally ahead of that by mining supporters. So, yes, this issue is hot and heavy.
Yeah, next Tuesday, you said?
Yes, in Virginia.
All right. Well, Marshall, let's move on to another story you've been covering. It has to do with a decision by the County Planning Commission. That's the St. Louis County Planning Commission?
Yes.
Is that right? And a conflict of interest about one of the members and an issue that's been going on. Tell us more about this one.
Yeah, well, this was kind of a very unusual case. It involved an after-the-fact conditional use permit for a fellow on Lake Vermilion who had last fall bought a property, a summer place on Lake Vermilion, on a very steep bluff and decided that he couldn't make it up the staircase that was already in place there to get from down to his dock, back and forth anyway, from the cabin to the dock. So he built a road down this steep bluff, and it was a steep road, and in parts this road was more than 45 degrees for extended stretches, which frankly I'm surprised he didn't hurt himself on this road if he had tried to use it. He was going to use an ATV to get back and forth. Well, anyway, the county found out about this and put a stop to it and said, you can't do that. I mean, it's against numerous regulations. So he decided he would file a permit anyway, an application for a permit. It was initially denied, but it then came back in April. And at the time, the application was presented not by the applicant, but by a county commissioner, Commissioner Keith Nelson, who also sits on the Planning Commission. A little bit unusual to have a county commissioner who's actually on the Planning Commission actually advocate for the application. He didn't vote on it that day, but when the matter came back before the Planning Commission last week, he did vote on it. And in the end, this thing passed. So at the time, some people had raised questions at the meeting whether or not he could be unbiased, given that he had advocated on behalf of the applicant here just a couple of months earlier. The St. Louis County Attorney's Office indicated on Tuesday that they will review that vote. So they are going to take a look at it. And the decision has really upset residents and township officials in Greenwood Township, which is where this applicant lives. And a few months ago, the township had handed over its zoning authority, planning and zoning authority, to St. Louis County. At the time, they had said they thought there were too many special deals and favoritism that had been part of the decision-making with the Township Planning Commission in the past, and they thought that they would get better handling and more professional decision-making by St. Louis County. And they generally give the St. Louis County staff high marks, but they said, you know, unfortunately, it appears that the same old politics are intervening here once they get to St. Louis County Planning Commission. So, and in fact, the staff in this case, the county staff, you know, they had presented a report on this application, as they do all the applications that come before the Planning Commission, and they had indicated that the application and the proposed new road that this guy wants to build are still in violation of multiple regulations, and it was not in compliance with the Lake Vermilion management plan. So they certainly indicated that, without saying it specifically, that they didn't believe this thing should be approved. Normally, actually, the staff will often actually give a recommendation either for approval or not approval. In this case, they were careful not to do that, and I suspect part of the reason was because there was a county commissioner who had clearly taken a advocacy position on behalf of the applicant. So definitely some politics appear to be at play on this decision, and it's making a lot of folks on Lake Vermilion pretty unhappy.
Marshall, in your role as a journalist, as you put all this information together, some interesting things came to light, and you have an editorial that has to do with it somewhat.
Well, I do, actually. In reporting on this, of course, I was reporting comments of some of the individuals who said they had concerns about Commissioner Nelson voting on this question here last week. And of course, so I emailed Commissioner Nelson and, you know, told him what the folks were saying and said I wanted to give him the opportunity to respond or comment in any way that he would like. And Commissioner Nelson responded exactly, and I'm reading it verbatim, "I love when people make up stories. When you become a reporter, they call it news. No fact-checking necessary." And I just couldn't help but see that as fodder for an editorial. Because, of course, you know, we've seen so many cases in recent years from the White House on down of politicians who apparently are not real happy with the scrutiny of the media, and they use every opportunity to try to attack the media, you know, and accusing us of not fact-checking, which I thought was particularly ironic, given that that's exactly what we were doing here, is getting the perspectives of everybody. And I pointed out, you know, just what goes into, you know, writing a typical news story like this. And, you know, in this particular instance, we had contacted 7 different sources, including interviews with most of them. We had reviewed a number of county documents and letters. And, you know, there's hours that go into producing a story like this. And we do all that fact-checking and work because we do want to have as accurate a portrayal of the facts of the case as possible. Funny that someone like Mr. Nelson didn't recognize that in contacting him and giving him the opportunity to weigh in on this, that we were doing our job. And frankly, he wasn't doing his job, and that he was, you know, basically preventing any accountability or scrutiny of his own actions. And I think every elected official should be willing to subject themselves to public inspection.
All right, Marshall, before we go, there's a story about Crane Lake. They are concerned in that community. They may be losing their customs office. How important is that customs office to the Crane Lake?
Well, it's critical. This customs office has been in place since 1953, and it's really helped Crane Lake economically. In fact, the seaplane base, the Scott's seaplane base, in Crane Lake is the busiest seaplane base outside of Alaska in the U.S. I mean, they have hundreds of planes that come in, you know, during the course of the season. It's all this cross-border activity, you know, folks going out to fly-in fishing camps or resorts in Canada, or folks in, you know, resorts on Crane Lake or maybe flying in for a day of fishing somewhere in Canada. It's become a really busy base, and obviously all that activity generates economic boom to the Crane Lake area. So they're obviously very concerned about maintaining that. Unfortunately, the customs office came to the current landowner or landlord here just recently and said they no longer want to pay any rent for the office that they've been leasing. And this was actually newly rebuilt by the landlord 10 years ago at the government's insistence. And so he, you know, he made a substantial investment in that, had expected to be able to continue to draw rent from that, obviously. The other concern, of course, is that in talking to local officials in Crane Lake, they say no business in the area is likely to be able to offer them free rent because, you know, there's obviously cost involved to maintain that space and pay property taxes, heat it, and, you know, all that, as well as the disruption to businesses as you're getting all this traffic in and out. So they're very concerned that this isn't resolved, that one of the potential outcomes could be the Customs Service deciding, well, we're not going to maintain an office there. There's also the possibility that the Customs Office is going to get rid of any staffing there. I talked to the Customs Office this week, and they said that they're actually looking at using a remote interactive mechanism, some new technology that would allow people to go back and forth across the border without actually having to deal with a customs officer face-to-face. That, would, of course, would require a good Internet connection, which folks in Crane Lake say they don't have. There's still some technical issues that would have to be worked out before that could happen. In the meantime, the customs office will be there at least through December because that's how long their lease goes for, but they don't agree to a renewal of this lease that could lead to closure of that office, and that's obviously a big concern to folks up there.
That is Marshall Helmberger. It's the Border News Roundup. You can read more at timberjay.com. Marshall, we'll check in with you next week.
Sounds great. Thanks, Heidi.